Tuesday, April 30th. April is always the busiest month of the year, and this year, the most dramatic, the fullest I've ever known. I find myself tired. It's hard to get up in the morning. Mm-hmm. It was around 8:30 when I went in Lyndon's room. Eric Hoffer was seated with him, his bulk filling the old wing chair, wearing, as always when I've seen him, a sort of workman's jacket. A man out of another age, cut to no pattern, intelligent, fresh, unique. He and Lyndon enjoy each other hugely and understand each other. I read the newspaper headlines, Poor People's Campaign beginning peacefully, groups calling on cabinet officers, still no agreement on site for peace talks, Columbia University being torn apart by the student revolt. But mostly, I drank my coffee and listened. Hoffer said, "Why doesn't the middle stand up? We are so scared of the young." About the Negroes. And find your face is black, consider yourself lucky. More doors are open to you than ever were before. There are more opportunities for you. Lyndon asked him about his job. Just what did he teach, how many hours, and so forth. He said, "I call myself a conversationalist in residence. Every Thursday afternoon," I believe that was the time, "I talk and people come in. They may be freshmen or PhDs or a cab driver or the waitress in a beer joint. Sometime in the morning, I had a talk with John Macy. I find him one of the most able members of this administration, one of those I would regret most saying goodbye to. But for me, the big event of the day was the Senate Ladies' Luncheon honoring me at the Capitol at 1 o'clock. It was held in the familiar old Senate caucus room, high-ceiled, handsome, scene of explosive gatherings, including the McCarthy years. But this one was a very happy gathering. Barely 100 of the Senate wives, including many wives of former members, Mary Elizabeth Kim, Katie Malone, Elizabeth Hennings, Mrs. Millard Tidings, who now has a new name, and the most faithful member, Mrs. Henry Wallace, who hasn't missed a time that I can remember, and is as gentle and quiet as her husband was controversial. It was a hugging and kissing receiving line. Everybody, I think, me most of all, was conscious that this would be my last time there as First Lady, my fifth. I took my seat by Muriel, who looked terribly weary. And on the other side, Betty Talmadge, who they said had drawn a lucky number, placing her there. And the two luncheon chairmen, Mrs. William Spong of Virginia, and Mrs. Aiken, the new wife of the venerable Senator Aiken of Vermont. And Vicky Haruska, Maggie Inouye. The whole theme was Hawaiian. The tables were scented with orchids that had been flown over. The menu, which was written in Hawaiian, offered us pineapple shells full of chicken and seafood and water chestnuts. And then for dessert, there came in little volcanoes of coconut ice cream, erupting clouds of smoke from the dry ice on which they were placed. I know that must have been a tense moment for the two committee chairmen until the dessert performed according to plan. Inevitably, I got a lay. Fortunately, it went well with the turquoise silk I had chosen to wear. And the entertainment was Hawaiian string music. Some of the people in Senator Fong's office with a lovely aloha for me. But the whole substance of the meal for me was the people, people, people. I looked around and saw Henrietta Hill, who had been desperately ill. I did not expect her to be there. In fact, I wondered if I'd ever see her again. And she looked quite well. Later, I heard the marvelous story of why. Mary Lasker had heard of a new drug that helped people with Parkinson's disease. She had kept beating on the doctor's doors, Henrietta's doctors, until they had used it. And for today, for some unforeseeable time, she was herself again, not even noticeably trembling. Mrs. Toby, who is our leader, no matter what administration is in power, and has the manner of a duchess with a sense of humor, I respect and like her immensely. Old-timers, such as Evie Symington and Mary Ellen Monroney, and a sprinkling of the young ones, neither of the Mrs. Kennedys, no surprise there. They were both out campaigning, and when it was time for the little speech, Muriel read a letter from Mrs. Frances Parkinson Kies, regretting that she couldn't be with us, gave me a diagram and a note that said the ladies of the Senate had planted a Chinese white dogwood in my honor on the Senate side of the Capitol grounds with a little plaque. I shall love that. It was distressing to watch Muriel speak. She was so weary, I almost feared she was going to faint. She stumbled over words and could hardly get through a sentence. She had told me during the meal she had made a flight, I think out to Chicago, for one of those innumerable charity events that she so valiantly attends for retarded children, this one at the urging of the Kennedys. She had not gotten home until 4:30 this morning, and she was going into the hospital for the operation right straight after the luncheon. I held my breath for her. I could see it was an endurance contest. And then it was my time to speak, and for once it was easy. During the luncheon, they had passed out fortune cookies, and in mine there had been a slip that said, "Be most affectionate today." The right words came, and the feeling was certainly there, and I was rather proud. My brief reminiscences about attending this luncheon for 12 years as a senator's wife, and then being president of the group for the 3 years that Lyndon was vice president, and then this the fifth and last time as honor guest, and assured them that I would be coming back on my cane as a former member, like so many of the guests in front of me. It was a sweet and pleasant time, and I left hugging all around, thanking all around, clutching my maple sugar candy in the shape of a leaf from Mrs. Flanders. There's been one every year for 20 years. Briefly looking at the layettes and the afghans which they prepare for service families. And then back to the White House, weary, a short nap, recording, work at the desk. And then about 7:30, the Joe Alsops arrived for dinner. There would just be the four of us. Lyndon was about an hour late. I enjoyed talking to them immensely. Joe is a rare man, and he too belongs to another age. Where in time to place him, I do not quite know. Wide-ranging interests. From archaeology, he has written a book on it. Antique furniture, gardening, gourmet cooking. He gets the same sort of a sensuous pleasure that I do out of a beautiful view. He stood in front of the window in the yellow room, looking out on the Jefferson Memorial. The same sort of satisfaction a hungry man would have from biting into a good steak. He talked about FDR's planning it for exactly that spot. In fact, I think he changed the location of it. He said it was like some palace, perhaps Versailles, with a long alley in the garden, and at the end, some lovely statuary. Lyndon came, there was a good dinner, and wide-ranging talk of international affairs and of this unbelievable spring we are living through. It was easy to see Lyndon was tired. Joe made a move to go at 10:30, and Lyndon didn't stop him. And then Chief Mills came, and I had a rub and was in bed by midnight. And so it has been a month since Lyndon made his momentous decision. How do we feel? Billy Connolly had said something like this. At first, you'll feel depressed, like the world had stopped. And then, after a while, enormously relaxed, relieved, happy. Well, certainly, as yet, there is no depression, no valley of the black pig, no slough of despond. At first, there were those 4 or 5 days of almost euphoric relief, with thousands of letters pouring in from all over the nation, mostly admiring, grateful, understanding, some urging us to reconsider, good editorials from places you never expected to get them, a sort of a preview of your obituary, perhaps. And then the whole nation had been jerked out of this mood by the hideous assassination of Martin Luther King and the ensuing riotings and killings in the cities. It is as though some beast abroad in the land has not been sated yet, his bloodlust not satisfied. What a time to live through. If we had hoped to lance the ball, to unite the country, we have just made an offering, made a start, and the future will have to tell how it works out. But as for us personally, our main feeling is of growing relief and satisfaction that Lyndon made his decision, and when he did, I think of what Trudy Fowler said when I went to a lunch given by Jane Wirtz for all the cabinet wives last Wednesday. She looked at me solemnly and said, "I think it was providential." Another feeling I have is of the clock ticking, of urgency. There's so many things I want to do in the remaining 8 2/3 months. So many people I want to have here to share this beautiful house. So many conservation measures to push an inch forward. were nailed down. Highway beautification, our own committee here in Washington, the Hirshhorn Museum. And then, while I am here, there are so many things I can do for the library with the staff and expertise available here that cannot be done afterward from the outside. The words of Mr. Neustadt ring in my ears. It's a lot easier to get things done when you are president. And I want to use this time, each day of it, as fully, glowingly, happily, usefully as I can. And what of Lyndon? An accelerated activity, if anything. No backward look, a determination to push with every power he has toward peace abroad and toward furthering his programs here at home. No glance backward. The most philosophic and detached I've ever seen him.